De la revolución del mundo.
Justice by any means
necessary.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
All right, okay, so we're going to get started just now, but I'm going to introduce James. We're going to be talking about his book today, Drinking Up the Revolution, but he is a writer and PhD candidate based in Winnipeg, and also the author of Do Androids Dream of Electric Cars? Public Transit in the Age of Google, Uber, and Elon Musk, as well as an upcoming book, Dogged and Destructive, Essays on the Winnipeg Police, that is coming out in a week. Very cool. James organizes with Winnipeg Police Cause Harm, and for transparency, so do I. That's how we know each other, and what brings us into this conversation together today. So just like the structure of the presentation, for the next 15 minutes or so, James is going to introduce like his book and the main arguments in it, and then I have some questions prepared that I'm going to ask him, and then we're going to open the floor to all of you to ask some questions. So,
yeah. Great. Firstly, thank you so much to everyone for being here. I know that there's other great sessions happening at the same time, so it means a lot that you'd come out to check this one out. I wanted to start by, and as just read out the COVID protocol that's being used for this conference, but I just wanted to acknowledge and thank the organizers of the events for doing that again this year. I think it's really an excellent example of what community-led system-level public health looks like, which is going to underpin a lot of the discussion today. I'm going to talk a little bit about sort of the thrust of the book, but of course it will be kept relatively condensed. So any questions that you may have, any things that you want to challenge or poke at or anything, will be in the question period, or maybe Inez will do it first, so we'll see. But the main objective of the book and of this talk is really just to get us to think and to talk about alcohol from a leftist perspective. And the reason that I say that needs to be prefaced first by why care about alcohol, given all the other issues that are facing us as leftist organizers in the world. I probably don't need to rattle them all off, given that that's been the conference, but whether it be Palestine or climate change or eviction crisis, or there's so many other fronts, the drug poisoning crisis, and so on. So the first thing that I wanted to flag really is that alcohol use affects many people, many oppressed communities, many people in working class communities. And we know statistically that there are relationships between experiences of trauma and experiences of displacement and all these sorts of things and alcohol-related harms. And we can get into why that is in a little bit. It also intersects with many other issues. So whether it be climate change, whether it be workers and labor rights, whether it be gentrification, there's many different intersections in which alcohol politics play a key role. And also it is a major public health issue in its own right. And I don't want to dwell too much on sort of the what will come across as the fear-mongery or like the overly public health aspects of it. But just to quickly, you know, emphasize the point that the WHO estimates that there's 2.6 to 3 million alcohol-related deaths that happen in the world every year. So these include acute injuries. So this will be accidental or intentional harm that happens. It can be poisonings, it can be falls, these sorts of things. There's also chronic harms. So these are things like eventual organ failures, whether it be to do with the cardiovascular or the digestive system. And then there is alcohol use dependency or alcohol use disorders. So this is in the realm of dependency. And with that said, that obviously doesn't include the harms that occur that may result in injuries or sicknesses or chronic harms over time. And even beyond that, it doesn't include the things that don't chart when it comes to health. So it may not result in someone going to a doctor and it being reported as that. And so just things to flag in terms of interpersonal conflicts or domestic disputes and domestic violence and these sorts of things. So I'll leave that sort of there at the moment, but that's sort of one of the overarching things is that I think we on the left need to take it seriously, because like many other things, whether it be COVID, whether it be the drug poisoning crisis, whether it be lack of access to health care, alcohol is a public health issue in itself. And I think many people will say, yes, sure it is, but the political, the structures in place, and if they are tightened, this will result in other issues that come up, and we'll get into what that could look like down the road. So I want to argue, really, that the contemporary left, and there's of course exceptions to this, but the contemporary left has largely abdicated involvement in the issue and the question of alcohol. And again, returning to what I mentioned earlier about how there's so many other issues confronting us, it's totally understandable. But one of the things that we'll explore throughout this presentation is that there's actually a really long history of leftist struggle around alcohol. It comes from many different perspectives, and there's contradictory, conflicting opinions on this. But really, the fact that there isn't really much of a discussion around it at this point is fairly new. And so this discussion, this book, this conversation that we're having is just really in the hope of trying to bring back some of that sort of conversation. So the reason that I think that there's sort of a bit of a failure of imagination in the way that we talk, or if we don't talk about alcohol, is that what we have, what the alcohol industry is, which I will get at in a little bit, has presented us with, is that the options for alcohol policy and regulation are either prohibition, and we know for many reasons that that is not desirable and does not lead to effective health outcomes, or it is fully commercialized industry. And so that is essentially what we have in most parts of the world, with some big exceptions. So the challenge or the provocation that I want to make is following the work of many other drug policy experts and people who intervene in these conversations to say that those are not the only options on the table. It's not only prohibition, it's not only fully commercialized industry. There is an in-between, and of course that in-between is very complex and requires a lot of really intense struggle to make sure that it is equitable and it is anti-racist and anti-colonial and all these things that we'll get into in the course of this conversation. But just to really stress that that's another sort of theme that we're going to get at throughout this conversation is just to remember that those are not the only two options. And finally, before we sort of move into the more questiony part of the conversation, is that I want to do a brief outline of what the industry is. And this is another sort of thing that I really want to stress, is that we need to develop a political economy of the global alcohol industry. And the reason I say that is because we as leftists do this for many other industries, as we should. we know the Apples and the Microsofts and the Walmarts and you know all of these major corporations. Oftentimes we know the names of the people who run the companies. We know the histories in terms of labor struggles. But for the most part, unless people work in the industry itself, and of course there's many people involved in those struggles on the ground, there isn't a great deal of awareness of who kind of constitutes the industry, so to speak. And this is partly due to alcohol just not being an issue that receives a lot of attention, but I argue that part of that is because the industry has worked really hard to essentially conceal or to downplay awareness of its activities. And we will talk about what those activities are, but in many cases, people may not know that, you know, for example, that their favorite craft beverage is owned by a multinational producer, sort of the networks that exist to really promote this and the ways that lobbyists and work at, you know, many different scales to really promote consumption at higher levels. And so to begin with, there's the producers, of course. So these are the brewers, the distillers, the winemakers, and it's especially concentrated in beer. So Anheuser-Busch or AB InBev is a conglomerate. It's a massive company at this point, which has just sort of gobbled up more and more companies over the course of the last several decades. And so they are split between Brazilian and Belgian billionaires. The Brazilian side is 3G Capital, which also owns Restaurant Brands International, which is like the Tim Hortons and the Popeyes and Burger Kings and all that sort of thing. And so they produce a simply gigantic amount of beer throughout the world. So they own the Budweisers, the Stellas, the Coronas. Their portfolio includes 500 different beers, and we'll get into it, but as the industry has expanded globally, this has included many local brands specific to sort of regional portfolios. So AB InBev is sort of, I refer to it as like the kingpin in terms of the alcohol industry, and so they're sort of the heavyweight. In terms of beer, there's also Heineken, which many people will be familiar with. An interesting difference between Heineken and AB InBev is that a lot of people may not know the name AB InBev, again, unless you work in an industry, whereas Heineken has really promoted itself, like that is the flagship brand. But Heineken also owns a massive portfolio of companies within its reach. And in the case of the UK, for example, that includes what they call pubcos. So those are essentially tied retail spaces. Again, we'll get into maybe the details if we want to. But so there's AB InBev, there's Heineken, there is Constellation Brands. I'm not going to like break down every single one of them. There's the Carlsbergs, and you know, like again, this is a regional for the most part. It's a regional discussion, but at the beer level, it really is these heavyweights that will operate. So, especially in the global south, for example, in Latin America, AB InBev and Heineken basically split entire markets almost in half. And I mean, that's a little bit of an oversimplification. But it's why I invoke Barron and Sweezy's concept of monopoly capital, which some may be familiar with, in terms of this specific industry, is that it really is the major players. And the reason this matters, aside from just the idea of how we think about consumer choice or availability or these sorts of things, is just to understand it from the perspective of political power. These are enormously powerful companies that have fought for a very, very long time in very concerted ways to establish and retain market share, but also to ensure that policies benefit their operations. So that's the beer market. The spirits is Diageo, which is kind of a UK monstrosity as well. This one's more sort of like finance capital owned, and the name itself was, I think, came up with from like PR or like sort of like branding. So that was the formation that happened a couple of decades ago, and they own a massive number of major spirits. They're also involved in wine as well. There's Pernod Ricard in France, which also owns a lot. They own 50% share of Havana Club, which is a Cuban national-owned rum. And then for the wine front, it is like a little... It's actually a lot less concentrated because it's such a regional product, but there's also powerhouses in that. E&J Gallo, the wine group. There's a lot of players within that. So that's the production front. And the one last thing I want to flag before going on is that there's several up and coming sort of brands or companies that are associated with new products. So people may be familiar with hard seltzers. this is a, you know, it's a ready to drink beverage. It's sort of the in between beer and spirits. And this is there's many of like the large companies that are producing this, but there's also some, like, for example, the producer of White Claw is a Canadian billionaire who also created Mike's Hard Lemonade. And so so these are sort of like, these are the new drinks that are in some ways challenging established relations of production, but at the same time are oftentimes just becoming like new players. So there's that, and then I will just, in the sake of time, I'll keep the other segments short, but there's the distribution aspect, and this is specifically powerful in the U.S. because of the three-tier way that post-prohibition landscape was established, where there was a divide between what was allowed for producers to be able to own. And so in the U.S. in particular, this created a very powerful distributor faction. So this is the people who are basically the in-betweens. And I won't get into it now, but they have immense power, and they, quite interestingly, will fight attempts to increase availability in certain avenues because it undercuts their own power and profits. So that's the distributor angle. And that can also include transportation, shipping, all these sorts of things, of which the major producers have significant shares in too. So for example, Canada, where I'm from, it's AB InBev, Molson Coors. They own massive distribution shares within the company, and so they are, it's sort of a vertical integration, which they own the production and the distribution. And finally, there's the retailers. So obviously this is where people purchase and sometimes enjoy if it's on-site consumption. So this would be the bars, the pubs, the restaurants for the on-site, and then the off-site would be the liquor stores, but oftentimes grocery stores is really one of the major players. So this includes the Costcos and the Tescos and the Walmarts. Again, I don't have to tell you, these are major players that benefit quite immensely from this. We can get into what's happening in Canada recently, because something that is, of course, interesting coming to the U.S. as a Canadian is seeing how different many parts of alcohol retail are. The fact that you can go to market just over here and there's alcohol products just like available at 9 a.m. or whatever is not something that is... I'm accustomed to in Canada, and I just want to stress that this is not inevitable, and I'm not making like a claim on whether this is good or bad at this point. I just want to say that this is the result of policy fights that industry has waged for many years and decades, and just to really stress that this is a very powerful industry. AB InBev, last time I checked, was the ninth largest advertiser in the world. They have, not just AB InBev, all of the producers mentioned have significant profitability, growing market share in a lot of landscapes, very intensive, sort of wars with workers. And so just to emphasize that this industry needs to be taken seriously, and that, as we'll explore sort of in our conversation, that this industry does not have the interests of the working class at heart. This does not mean that alcohol policy is not an intensely complex landscape, but we need to remember that that the industry fights incredibly hard to develop and to retain the way that we generally think about alcohol and its availability in society. So on that note, I'll pass the mic back to Inez so that we can start our conversation. And then, as mentioned, there'll be lots of room for questions and discussion and that sort of thing.
Okay, lots of good information there. I think the first question, like when I was thinking through like what to ask, the first thing that comes to mind in reading the book is, you know, you explain like why this is an issue that we should care about despite all of these other like current challenges that we're facing, which brings me to my question of like, why is it something that drew you in? Like, why did you choose to write the book? And like, how did you become interested in alcohol policy?
Yeah, for sure. So like many people, I have used alcohol for many years. it's obviously an incredibly popular and available and enjoyable substance. And so this is something that I try to emphasize, is that there are countless use values for alcohol, whether that be for relaxation and socialization or coping with X, Y, or Z issue in life, self-medication, all these sorts of things. So I think for me, it was just, it was a great way to socialize with friends, to relax. I, whether rightfully or wrongfully, would associate it with sort of like creativity, you know, and writing and that sort of thing. I'm less keen on that concept these days. But just my own sort of personal drinking. And over time, I started to just think, and this was because I was progressively just drinking more, and it was having various impacts on my life, and so I started to think a little more critically about that. And then as I sort of started to poke around just to see what was available out there, I realized that there really wasn't much of a left critique of alcohol that addressed it from the perspective of critiquing industry. And for me, that sort of like bothered me because production it should be a focus of Marxists and of socialists. There's of course exceptions to this, and some of those exceptions we'll explore in our conversation. But I think it was just progressively becoming more aware and thinking about how this ultimately left alcohol use to the individual, and it was sort of this individualizing neoliberal libertarian approach to alcohol use or to substance use in general. So just to give one quick example, this led me to doing some sort of like investigative journalism work around a pilot project that some public health experts out in British Columbia were working to do, and this was around the effects of warning labels, especially in regards to notifying people about the impacts of cancer, which alcohol is linked to 6 to 7 and possibly more different types of cancer. And so the pilot project was basically seeking to see if people having sort of tobacco style labels on bottles would affect consumption rates. And very quickly, as you may not be surprised, the alcohol lobbies threatened to sue. So this was the three major companies or the three major lobby groups in Canada. They didn't say it outright, but it's as close to outright as you can get that if you don't suspend this pilot project. Again, government funded, public health, had gone through years of design and oversight and all the rest. If they didn't pull that, they would sue. And so that's what happened. The pilot project was suspended. The researchers were able to get a sizable amount of findings out of the project, even though it was canceled. And what they did find was that there was a significant difference between labeled and unlabeled bottles. But the reason that I bring that up was it was sort of through that process of trying to get some of this information, trying to get the lobbyists on record to say, you know, what their perspectives on this were, and just sort of realizing the machinations and how much is going on behind the scenes that isn't really known or talked about. So those were sort of some of the big motivations. And then just sort of the final piece was just sort of like at a personal level, just impacts of alcohol use on family and friends, and the feeling that there was no help, there was no response to it that didn't just end up individualizing and sort of demanding abstinence as a condition of receiving help, and the stigma and the shame that is associated with that. So all of these things sort of combined into just starting to research and to write about this.
Okay, thank you. I think like kind of the core of the book, and at least like one of my favorite arguments when I was reading it, is like challenging these like conventional ideas of supply and demand of alcohol. So generally, like the story goes that like people want alcohol, and then producers and distributors make it available to them. And actually like having access to alcohol is important because like people need it and people want it, and they should have choices of what they can and want to consume, and they should have choices of like where and how they consume. And you challenge that. So I think I would like it if you could speak a little bit to like what's true about that narrative and what isn't.
Yeah, for sure. That's a great question. And this, like, to start with, it requires acknowledging, of course, that there is an incredibly long history of alcohol use that spans thousands of years in many societies. And there are many, again, many established use values, whether it's for pleasure or ceremony or, you know, any number of different things. And, you know, there's many writings on the importance and the histories of this, all of which are super interesting and worth understanding. And, you know, in the present, there's, again, many reasons that people drink, that people will use alcohol alongside other drugs, that people will navigate different relations with alcohol over time. These are, again, super important conversations, and any sort of equitable, progressive, socialist politics of alcohol has to really get into the nitty-gritty on this. With that said, and sort of what you flagged was... For me, what was missing from a lot of these accounts, again, is the role of production. Yes, supply is corresponding and is in relation to demand. Like, if they just produce massive amounts of a commodity that no one wants, as Marx talked about on like page one or two of Capital, then it is no longer capital. It will go to waste. So it's not like alcohol as a product was conjured out of thin air. At the same time, you know, the amount and the availability and the affordability, relatively speaking, of alcohol in the present day is unprecedented in many many places. And the way I think this is most notable, if we look at how the alcohol industry expands into much of the global South, which we can talk more in specifics in a little bit. But the consumption rates and, of course, the corresponding harms and health impacts of that have skyrocketed in many countries as industry has basically landed. And part of that, people will correctly argue, is the replacement of illicit or unrecorded supply of alcohol with commercial alcohol. But even like when that's factored in, it's still a massive increase in usage. And so that's one piece. And then the other piece, I think, is just to realize that industry works really, like, so part of the Baron and Sweezy's monopoly capital thesis very, very quickly is that the massive players in any given industry essentially realize that price cutting is a self-sabotaging strategy. And so there's sort of this, it's not a cartel, but it's sort of this agreement that companies will not, the largest companies will not engage in price cutting that will undercut the profitability of all players. And so what that leaves is immense efforts being put into things like branding and marketing, and in terms of product differentiation and these sorts of measures. And so that's not to say that there aren't a lot of differences in alcoholic products. Of course there are. But these brands and these companies work extremely hard to promote usage of it in new contexts that they're in. And that also involves sort of reshaping, or in some cases, the alcohol industry will directly shape the creation of alcohol policies that enable or that facilitate increased usage over time. And so that's sort of that's how I want to problematize, you know, yeah, again, of course, supply and demand is part of any capitalist markets, but it really is about profitability. These are, again, massively powerful companies. They care about one thing, and that is profit, and that is about competition and outcompeting their rivals. And so that's another part of Baron and Sweezy's argument is, yeah, okay, these large companies sort of have this truce of sorts that they're not going to engage in reckless price cutting, but that doesn't mean that they don't work really, really hard to push each other out of the market that they're competing in. So that's sort of how I address the supply and demand piece, because I think that is one of the core narratives, is that these companies are just responding to sort of latent demand, or, you know, there's just this, like, it's just always been there. People always drink. People will always want to drink. And I think that sort of undercuts the possibility of us sort of thinking more critically or developing a more rigorous analysis of what's going on at sort of a political economic level. And just to reiterate, none of this suggests that there's sort of like false consciousness being imposed on drinkers. It's to say that the material landscape in which alcohol use is made available is itself produced by industry. And I don't think that this is controversial for basically any other industry to say, you know, we can acknowledge, for example, that Apple makes laptops that people purchase and people want those laptops, but that demand doesn't come from nowhere. And so I'll just leave it at that for now, but that's sort of how I'm navigating that tension.
Okay, so then again, going back to something you said, like in your first introduction, you mentioned that like your favorite craft brewer might be owned by like one of these like giant corporations, but like, are there craft brewers that aren't? Like, does that make a difference when you, like, if you had smaller craft brewers? Or thinking of, like, alcohol isn't only produced commercially. Like, people produce alcohol in their homes. People produce alcohol in prison. So, like, thinking of these, like, other locations where people make and consume beverages and, like, what that means in terms of alcohol policy.
Yeah, craft production is really, I would say, the number one rebuttal to this concept of the monolithic, the monopoly capital, because that is really how the narrative has been sold, is that craft production represents this creativity and ingenuity that tastes far more complex, and there's all these sorts of things, many of which are true. Like, you know, craft products tend to be more delicious, to put it bluntly, and they exist in different spaces in terms of brew pubs and in terms of sort of certain neighborhoods and the cultural cachet that comes with that. The way that I push back against the what I would describe as sort of like a fetishization of the small scale producer, it happens on sort of like a number of fronts. The first is that even though craft producers, and again, this is a regional thing, I'm just going to keep saying that, but they do play significant roles in some places, but even in those places, sort of by a volume and by a profit or by revenue standards, they still represent a small fraction of the total markets. And so that's sort of the first thing, is that, you know, 10%, 12%, 15% of a market may be, constituted by craft producers. But the remainder of this is, again, this is the AB InBevs, the Molson Coors, the Diageos, the heavyweights. The second thing that I would say is sort of, as you flagged in the question, many craft producers have been systematically bought up by these massive multinationals because they represent a really lucrative addition to the portfolio. And so this is just smart business from the perspective of these massive companies, is that they realize that there is an interest in their customer base or possible customer base, and so they have systematically bought up a lot of these. They'll buy, they'll sell them. They will, and like from a craft producer perspective, it oftentimes makes sense. I say that with caveats, but because of what I mentioned about the ownership of distribution, it can be really hard to crack into markets if you don't have this sort of national and international backing. And so these multinationals, because they do have these monopolies on a lot of these networks, it can be really beneficial, at least for the owners, to eventually get acquired by these multinationals. And so there's that piece as well. The final thing I'll say for now, because you'd also mentioned sort of other small scale producers, and so this is something we're seeing in the Global South, especially, is that unrecorded or illicit alcohol constitutes an estimated 1/4 of global production. And so this would be the things that it's especially prevalent in sub-Saharan Africa and parts of Asia, is producing things in your own stills or in your own homebrew sort of setups or these sorts of things. And for a lot of people, it can be an important economic contributor on a very small scale. Again, small scale being sort of the key word here. Multinational companies see this as a business opportunity. They see their role ultimately as being able to substitute through their commercial production and commercial scaling up of consumption. And to do that, what they have done is really paint this unrecorded alcohol, which, for example, is produced by like Ugandan women, as something that is a specific health threat. And to be clear, there are specific health threats that are associated with sort of unlicensed or unregulated alcohol production, in terms of the things that can go wrong in a contaminated or poisoned batch. But what industry does is they essentially make the claim that their product is going to be an effective substitute to this. And I would argue that this is, in many cases, highly racialized, is that they paint entire sectors of small-scale production as basically contaminated and as in need of displacement. And they can extract massive tax concessions, state supports, all these sorts of things in order to bust into a market. And then once they do that, they will basically scale up production through what they call like a price ladder. And so they will establish sort of a portfolio of commodities available. So it's a way of very systematically pushing out. I mean, it's sort of a quote unquote primitive or primary accumulation tactic, or accumulation by dispossession, is you have to get rid of the possible competition. And they have done that by engaging in some really insidious tropes, I would say. And so I know that this is like sort of a winding response to the small scale question. But just to sort of summarize, is that sort of at a national, continental, global level, small-scale production represents a fairly small fraction of the global volume and revenues. And so when we talk about the industry, we have to keep that in mind, is that even though craft does represent certain interesting beverage options, it's still, again, it's a fraction. Second is that they are very systematically buying up this competition. They don't see them as threats. They see them as profit opportunities, and that can even mean just waiting, letting them do their own sort of creative, interesting thing, and once it's creative and interesting and profitable enough, then they can snap them up. And then third is that they are engaging in very, I just keep saying systematic, but it is systematic, expansion into the global south by really painting what is existing sort of unrecorded or illicit alcohol as especially nefarious, especially worrisome, and replacing that product. And as we'll sort of talk about, it very conveniently omits that in many cases the most impactful part of alcohol from a health perspective is the alcohol itself. And yeah, again, we can talk about, and this isn't to downplay the real threats of small-scale sort of illicit production, but I just really want to emphasize that there are very specific intentions to that sort of discourse.
Okay. Thank you for that. I guess maybe a small pivot, but you and I organize against police together, and would you be able to talk a little bit, you know, like in a lot of the organizing we do when we talk about, you know, police-free cities, and a world without police, issues around public safety come up, and like generally questions around public drug use and drug use more broadly. So both from the perspective of like people feeling unsafe, and we spend a lot of energy trying to dispel those myths, and then also trying to think towards policies that would make drug use safer. So in terms of thinking of like safe supply and other policies like that. But alcohol policy really doesn't come up as much in conversations around police. But would you be able to speak a little bit to how this relates to police abolition and other liberatory struggles?
Yeah, for sure. It's a big question, and I'll try to keep it brief. Yeah, you're right that alcohol often sort of doesn't get analyzed head-on when it comes to this. But I think most obviously we see this in terms of like public consumption, and everything in regards to the policing of alcohol use is deeply racialized and deeply class-based in terms of people who are unhoused, people who are using other substances, all these sorts of things. We saw this during the first year of the pandemic when there were, you know, bars and restaurants were closed and people were drinking outside, and the research that was done around the ticketing of public consumption, which is like that is the public health option on the table, is for people to consume outside, was overwhelmingly in line with everything else we know about policing, was overwhelmingly racialized. Black and Latino people in New York, for example. And so that's sort of the big one, or the most obvious one. But I argue in one of the chapters of the book, and we can get more into this later if we want, but the industry is really invested in the concept of the problem drinker, or responsible drinking is how we would more conventionally see it. You know, you see it at the bottom of every alcohol ad is drink responsibly, or some sort of play on that. And what I argue is that this relies on the image of the problem drinker being someone who is basically incapable of using alcohol in a responsible way. And so this is where we get the image or the discourse of, sort of the alcoholic who's so far beyond what the rest of us, and in terms of how we use alcohol, exists, and that is, you know, really, it's a fundamentally racialized history. So for example, we're living and organizing in Canada, and in terms of the history of restriction of alcohol to Indigenous peoples, like we often and rightfully so understand prohibition to be a deeply racialized history, like prohibition in the U.S. But alcohol was banned in terms, or like the use of alcohol was banned for Indigenous peoples in the Indian Act of the 1860s. And so this was a really key opportunity for the development and the strengthening of policing Indigenous peoples throughout Canada. And so so in terms of thinking sort of beyond this, beyond like refusing this individualizing, which is fundamentally a racialized discourse, I think it's just absolutely key to refuse just the notion of the problem drinker, and to emphasize that this doesn't mean that people have varying relations with alcohol, some of which are not ideal, some of which are whatever. Like, you know, I'm not going to make some. Yeah, anyways, but I think it's like the key response to this is to pivot from focusing on the individual to understanding this as a system level production of consumption. Currently the way that policing manages and contains primarily racialized drinkers is to caricature this idea of the problem drinker that has to be removed from society, as opposed to what I think we need to propose as a liberatory or more liberatory framework of understanding this as a structural, as a systemic issue, which is deeply embedded in racist and colonial systems. We see this constantly in Winnipeg, for example, where we organize in terms of the way that police will justify the killing of primarily Indigenous peoples on the basis of their substance use. And they will caricature that as, you know, posing a threat to themselves or to other people, and so on and so forth. And what this allows them to do is to abdicate them, and also the state that benefits from alcohol sales and the companies themselves. It allows any consideration of settler colonialism and the direct role that police play in it, and the traumas that are produced through it. And it also means that there's no system level analysis of why alcohol is as available as it is, and why there are so few options for people to experience joy or pleasure or relaxation or self-medication in any other way. So it's a big subject, but those are sort of some of the things that come to mind.
Okay, we keep promising everybody like a discussion period, and now it's just the two of us talking. So I'm going to ask you two more questions, sure. And then we'll open the floor. But I guess then, so thinking through solutions, like in the simplest terms, but then please elaborate, because then it won't be a very good answer. But like, if you're framing alcohol, like current alcohol use, as like a public health issue, and thinking of it also as like an issue of like regulatory capture in the market by like big players in the alcohol industry, like what kind of solutions are you looking towards? Like, is this like antitrust laws and like competition that would be coming into place? Is this like through a public health lens, or like is this something else altogether?
Yeah, the way that I frame it in the book is it sort of says it in the subtitle, but it's how to smash big alcohol and reclaim working class joy. The proposal really is that we need to, and this is riffing off of sort of like the degrowth framing within ecological struggles, is that we need to degrow the power of basically monopoly capital's capture and ownership of alcohol through a series of measures, which ultimately ends with the nationalization and socialization of industry, of which there is actually a really long history in revolutionary struggles throughout the world of this. And I know that that seems like an absolutely impossible sort of ask or thing to think about at this time, but it really is about treating alcohol as something that should be owned and distributed as a public good, and to remove the profit motive from that. And so obviously that's a really big sort of horizon, and there's other sort of smaller but I would say equally as important things that we can address that I get into in the book. But the other part of that is we need to, so there's the degrow, the major alcohol players, but there's also the sort of the regrowing community-led solutions and responses. And so, you know, this includes things like legalizing and regulating other psychoactive drugs. There's a lot of drugs that, you know, sort of pound for pound are less harmful than alcohol, to put simply. And the really big thing I would emphasize about this is that legalization and regulation has to be done through public ownership and through collective ownership. I argue in the book that the way that alcohol has been legalized and regulated in terms of this almost fully commercialized approach is one of the worst ways that you could possibly do that. And I think that accounts for a great deal of the alcohol-related harms that exist. And so it really is about, for example, providing other things like other legal and regulated drugs. It means things like more public spaces, more public amenities, more things for people to do. You know, something that we're seeing in Winnipeg is that there's growing, you know, reports of youth violent crime, and something that is rarely addressed in how this is reported is that since the start of COVID, there's been a systematic dismantling of things for like youth programs and things for people to like actually do. So that's an extreme example, but it's like, it's no wonder that people are getting up to things. It's like, what else do you expect them to do? So for like, I know it may not seem like a convincing solution to many of the things that we're talking about today, but like even things like all age venues, like this used to be a thing in a lot of cities, and you know, like, and you know, like, that comes out of punk and radical circles, that the idea that people should have opportunities to enjoy music, to enjoy culture, to enjoy pleasure that don't necessarily mandate alcohol use as a condition of that. You know, parks, pools, public transit, you know, I can go on and on about the things, and this may seem overly reductive in terms of sort of the scope of the issue, but I think that, and it's why I sort of emphasize pleasure and enjoyment, is because these are the things that draw people to alcohol. Like I mentioned the public health issues, but a lot of people are like, yeah, but that's just the cost of me having a good time. And so my perspective is that we really need to approach this from sort of a substitutionist approach, is that we need to, and this is sort of where public health as an institution runs into problems, and maybe we can talk about this more in the Q&A portion, but public health often does a decent job of illustrating the impacts of alcohol use. And there's been recent flare-ups in Canada over this around like low-risk drinking guidelines, for example. But the conclusion or the implicit conclusion is always you need to use less or preferably no alcohol, but that's it. Like you just like phase it out. And for some people that may be what's needed or what's desired. But for a lot of other people, they still want to have good times or have ways to deal with like the crushing despair of like contemporary life, and so long as we're not addressing that people desire these things, I think that we're going to continue to run into issues. And so I'll leave it at that for now, just in the interest of time and opening up the conversation. But
you like half answered the second question that I was going to ask, but like that's okay. You don't have to apologize. Yeah, so like right now we see a lot of like organizing around like drug user liberation and thinking of like decriminalization, regulation, legalization of, or like what's like commonly referred to as safe supply. And I think you answered that in terms of like there are lessons that can be learned from alcohol legalization and regulation, that like how you do it matters. But do you think there's lessons that can be learned from drug user advocacy that can be brought into alcohol policy?
Yeah, definitely. And like I start out the book by basically shouting out this work of drug user activists. In Vancouver, in Canada, there's Drug User Liberation Front, or DULF, which has been doing incredible work around safe supply, including small-scale distribution of basically a safe supply, a legal and regulated supply, as much as that can be done in the current conditions. And it's an incredibly difficult and courageous fight where people are literally fighting for the ability for them and their friends and their loved ones to survive, because the toxic drug poisoning crisis is absolutely devastating. I probably don't need to tell anyone that, but yeah, killing thousands of people, tens of thousands of people every year. And so the reason I bring that up is that drug user activism it's like a big thing, but I would say one of the core things is that it really is focused on community-led, peer-led responses, and understanding drug users as experts, and really emphasizing drug users as policymakers and as people who need to be sort of beyond consulted, like really deeply embedded in these sorts of things. But one of the other things I would sort of emphasize, and I've alluded to it, but maybe not really articulated as clearly as I should have, but I think the thing is that abstinence is not the goal for most drug user activists. And I think, based on the public health research I just mentioned, is that what we know is that, any amount of alcohol consumption is unsafe to some degree, but it really is about the amount that you drink on a regular basis. The more you drink, the more you increase risks of acute, chronic dependency, et cetera, et cetera. And what drug user activists really have successfully emphasized, I think, in reaction to sort of like the treatment or the rehab mandates that's, right-wing reactionary forces are trying to implement, is that that is not the only way that people can receive care or should receive care. Again, this returns to understanding drug users as experts, and also, acknowledging that the drinkers or other substance users may not want to quit. Like, they may want to reduce their usage. They may want to come into a different sort of relationship with a substance. But I think that sort of approach, and it sounds like kind of silly to have to say out loud, but at the end of the day, it's about reducing harm over time. And for many people, that means simply it could be just like reducing usage or having more more support, so like housing or food or income supports or any number of other things that allow them to sort of cultivate a different relationship with a substance. Or maybe not at all, right? Maybe it just comes down to using substances in different ways. So I think that that is like one of the really key lessons from drug user activists. And, I mean, there's many, many others, but that would be the big one, is that if we want to take alcohol harm seriously, it means that we should be, you know, for some people that may mean quitting entirely. Other, many, many other people, it just means reducing intake or managing intake or getting intake to a point where it, risk levels are reduced. And so I think that's a really major part of drug user activism, yeah.
I'm going to be so sneaky and ask you one more question, but look, you only can answer it for a minute and a half.
Okay.
But can you explain the title of the book?
Yeah, for sure. So the title is "Drinking Up the Revolution," and this is a play on. That's the cover. So actually the cover and the title are both riffs off of Soviet related sort of imagery or whatnot. But it's a Trotsky quote. He talks, or during the October Revolution, alcohol use was seen as a pretty major impediment to the success and the defense, most importantly, of the Bolshevik gains. Both Leon and Trotsky had been very opposed to the way that alcohol had been regulated, and specifically the way that the Russian, the Tsarist state had relied on vodka revenues. And there's a scholar named Mark Lawrence Schrard who talks about this really interestingly in a book called Vodka Politics. And there's another one more recently called Smashing the Liquor Machine, which are really interesting. There was a lot of concern about this at the time of the October Revolution. And so, Trotsky specifically said, this was just after the capturing of the Winter Palace. He said, quote, "If we don't stamp out alcoholism, then we will drink up socialism and drink up the October Revolution." And so that led to a series of pretty draconian measures, including like the nationalization and the immediate banning of state alcohol production, of cellars being raided, and barrels being slashed open with bayonets and all these sorts of things. That's not like an endorsement of the policy per se, but the reason that I kind of like that framing was in my mind in my mind alcohol is an important thing for us to think about, not only in the distant future but also in the present day. That doesn't mean that, you know, we can necessarily address all of these issues in the present. We do need socialism. We need to fight for socialism. But I think if we look through the history of these sorts of struggles, it hasn't been seen as just sort of a peripheral thing that we can address one day. It's like we need to fight for health. We need to fight for safety. And that, in their case, it was fighting for the preservation of the revolution. And I've never experienced a revolution, but that's sort of just what the title is trying to signal. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. That was-
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.